Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Second Chance Podcast. In this episode, I'm speaking with Junior Smart, a former gang member who was sentenced to 12 years in prison for possession of several kilograms of crack cocaine. In prison, Junior suffered from depression and contemplated committing suicide. On the day he planned to take his own life, a prison officer slid an envelope under the door of his cell containing photos of past family get-togethers. Junior talks about how the photos snapped him back to reality and saved his life. He then sought help from the prison Samaritans and trained to become a listener himself. He soon discovered other areas that lacked in support. He decided to do something about it and make a change. He became a mentor for young offenders, leading him to meet with St. Giles Trust and setting up his successful SOS project. This became London's largest gang exit program.
Let me start, Junior. You know, the theme of my podcast is second chance. And so let me kick it off by asking you what that term means to you, because it has lots of different meanings for different people, depending. You know, people often ask me what my second chance was, and I don't think anybody gave me a second chance. I kind of took back my life, having been wrongly convicted and imprisoned, et cetera, et cetera. So what does the term second chance mean to you as an individual, but also as a practitioner?
Wow. Second chance to me means so many different things. It means being reborn to me, like, and I don't mean that in a spiritual way, but not in a religious way. I mean being reborn. Like I look at the world now with new eyes, with new sensitivity. I'll give you a really good example. So I remember when we had the Twin Towers. At that point, I was a different type of man. I was sitting in my house. We were bunning it down. My boys were around me. We saw it. We were all shocked by it, but it didn't hit me. And now when I think about it now, my sensitivity range is a lot more deep. It's a lot more deeper than that. If I was to think about 911 now, I think about all the passengers and that absolute fear that must have gripped. Do you understand my sensitivity now is a different level? Yesterday, I was speaking at an anti-arms demonstration purely because my sensitivity now connects with the people that cannot speak for themselves. That's what I mean by being reborn. Like, in some ways, it would have been better if they'd have just left me alone back then, because right now I wouldn't have achieved anything, probably. I would have been just society. I would have just carried on being what society thought. I remember, I think it was Carl Jung that said, they who don't know who they are, ask the world and the world will tell them. Well, I wasn't a nice guy. I wasn't directed. I wasn't sensitive. Being reborn to me now means reconnecting in a way with reality that I never did before. Connecting with the suffering, connecting with a feeling of change. Like yesterday, I walked away from it and I felt like, oh my gosh, like that was the best use of my time. The last time I felt like that, I was in a school talking to school children. That's what I mean by being reborn. Reborn means getting a second mortgage on life. You know, like I'm living in a different way. I'm trying to live up to values in a different way. It doesn't mean making it perfect. I'm far from perfect, but I'm driven by different factors now. And being reborn to me means having a second chance at family relationships, relationships that I destroyed by my actions, relationships that I damaged. That's what having a second chance to me means. It's not just coming out of prison and being given a second chance at re-entering society. Oh no, like mine is a lot more deeper than that.
It's so interesting that you talk about the sensitivity that you experience and explore now to when you was, like you say, sitting in a room with your boys watching what was unfolding on the television as many people was around the world. And at that point you say, well, you didn't say the word, but I suspect you're saying that you were desensitized or unsensitive. What, tell me what you mean by that. I mean, what are you saying? That the life you were leading meant you had no sensitivities to the impact the world was having on other people. What do you mean by that, Junior?
There are loads of us that go through this world blind. There are loads of us that turn our eyes away from things in society that are important. You know, where I'm living right now, there's a massive homelessness problem. There's a massive homelessness problem. And I remember, you know, when I was living in London, like I was working for a company and I remember looking out the window and seeing children go to the rubbish bins and literally pulling stuff out and eating it. And it hit me like, my gosh, that's shocking to see. But it didn't really hit me. And I think that's because a lot of us in this world go around either there's stuff that we see and we don't like it and we turn our eyes away from it. Or at some point, I think because I was asking questions yesterday, how many people can be happy knowing that people are dying innocently? I honestly think people can stomach it. I think we see enough stuff on TV, on the media, and we absorb the rhetoric that it's them, it's not us. It's not happening on our doorstep. It's not happening to children or our family members. So therefore, it's kind of someone else's problem. And that's kind of, and sometimes I think to an element of the life I was living before, there was a level of dissidence to almost like self-protect myself. Do you know, like, why should I absorb that? That's nothing to do with me. And that kind of keeps you living a real kind of life. It allows you to carry on doing what you're doing. But like I said, like if I, you know, when I think about it now, oh my gosh, it was shocking. It was massively shocking and awful.
Yeah, it's interesting. All right. So to understand who Junior Smart is today, let's go back to who Junior Smart was before he became the man that he is today. So just talk to me a little bit about your upbringing, where you grew up, what life was like for you growing up and the sorts of things that you were getting up to, which eventually led to you going to prison. I don't know how many times you went to prison. So just give my listeners and me some of your backstory, Junior.
So the first thing to say is I'm not a typical, what they would say, gang member, if you even want to call it that. And then there's a lot of stuff out there that's kind of about my background that's kind of mystified and added to. And none of that is actual accurate. I wasn't raised in a single parent household. There were two people there. There was one of them's my mum. I had a stepdad. It was authoritarian, you know, like you live by the rules of the house or else there's consequences. But to be fair, I have to give them both respect. Mum tried really hard. You can't just talk about that time without understanding the age of what was going on. This was the 1970s. Racism was rife. My mum was a nurse, and she gave up. She gave up nursing because I had like a blood condition. I still have it. It's sickle cell anemia. But that meant that we immediately had a knock on effect on the household income. She left my real father because he was a violent man. None of that, which I remember. This is all stuff I'm told. It wasn't an ideal life, but we tried, we coped, and it was me and my sister. And I would never have said it was, we grew up on a housing estate, but you've got to understand all of those rifts, the racism, the prejudice, there's pressure to conform, there's pressure to rise up to the challenge. You know, like the problem that you have when you've got an estate where there's children, you know, like Lego brick next to each other, is that everybody ultimately to some level has a competition of resources. Everyone's competing to be the person who's on top. And that leads to conflict in all sorts of different ways. I would never have said it was a gang. I would have said it was a group of friends. And it wasn't, you know, this was a world that I was able to dip in and dip out of without much consequence until after, you know, my mother died and our lives went into kind of like a weird free-for-all, and it became more about money then.
How old was you when your mum died?
So you see, this is what was mad about it. I'd been arrested. I'd been on bail for numerous different things, but I'd always managed to get away with it.
What kind of things are you talking about? What kind of activity? I mean, are we talking shoplifting, drug dealing, violence?
I'll be real with you. I handled a gun before I was 12, but would I have said I've been done for a firearms offence? No. I've been done for, I mean, I think if you look through the history, there's things that are like arson, robbery, all sorts of stuff. Kind of juvenile, kind of, you know, the police arrested me on my front door before, led me out on the estate in handcuffs. But I always got away with it. I was bailed and I was fortunate enough to get away with it. When Mum died, I was like 20, 21. And then, yeah, I started. It wasn't like, the thing was, I was working. We were all raised to work hard, me and my sister, and that my sister never got involved in anything. But the problem that kind of arose out of it was when you're involved in that kind of lifestyle, money comes, money goes very quickly. And it wasn't until like much later that you get, when you actually stop and you look, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this and you've sort of like made these things like an abstract and you look at things objectively, that you see where all the faults are. That is, those are people, for example, that are trying to save money, but they haven't looked at their income and their outcome and goings effectively to realise actually maybe that they're missing a grand just because they're spending how much money on fast food takeaways or coffees or whatever else. Yeah, they're not looking at things in the abstract because you're running the race. And that was basically it. So even though I was working and I was making money illegally through my friends, that money was being spent on silly stuff, trainers, drugs, women, my car, all sorts of stuff. So I was trying to run up an escalator that's basically working in reverse. And so I never actually, so basically from my side of it, all that ended up happening was my risk element started to rise because I was doing things more and more risky in order to make more and more money. And it just massively backfired. And I say all of that, but you see, what was crazy was in the journey to making that money, there were things that were coming up. So like, for example, there were a couple of situations where we as a crew, we were threatened. And I stood up, I put my head above the parapet. And when the showdown came, I say it now purely because it was more by luck, I'd come out on top. Now, in the commons, most people say, my gosh, what you've just done is crazy, blah, 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 stop. Like, this thing's going too far. But I'm involved in a circle of a clique that they're saying to me, no, man, Jay, you're untouchable, you're this, you're that. And then so I start thinking, well, if I've done that and I've gotten away with those charges, what else can I do? And then you see everything just got more and more serious. But anyway, I got sent down for 12 years originally for something that was relatively quite minor. And then literally in that time, I decided, I mean, and it really was that first night I was in custody that I decided that I needed to do something about it. It was awful, absolutely awful. Like when I say that no solicitor would show up, because I was banged to rights, it was a large sum of drugs and it was a maximum purity. No solicitor would turn up. My sister's breaking because I used to be one person inside of the house, another person outside the house. So she thought, right, actually, Junior's just going to get in trouble for cannabis. She had no idea it was going to be crack cocaine. And then when all of the other stuff started to come out, but, you know, she held it together. She tried to be there for me. It was terrible. And that first night in custody, it was when no one would show up for me that I realised, wow, like and for all my friends and everybody that was around me, yeah, man, it was a massive wake up call.
How can I ask? You know, so you were obviously living this life. Like kids today, they call them roadman, they call them all kinds of things. I mean, I grew up like you on a council estate, and I lived that world myself. So I kind of, and I don't know what part of the world I'm suspecting somewhere in London, but whatever there. There came a time when you did get arrested and ended up in custody, but how do you get caught? Because like you say, you got in trouble with the law on many occasions, you managed to break free from certain charges or whatever, but how did you end up getting caught for something so serious that you ended up going to prison? And when I say caught, I don't mean, you know, I don't know what I mean. I'm asking you, you tell me.
Okay, so there was a number of different things that was happening, okay? And different people have different stories about this, so... There was a number of times where I was told to go and link someone with packages, and I'd show up, and these were minors, yeah, minors. I used to have a bit of a temper problem. Like I go from 0 to 100. That's what my sister was saying. Unfreaking predictable. So I kicked off with them about that, and in fact, what I did was I lied to the children. I made them some mash. Like literally, like, which is what we call, you know, I don't know if you know what mash is, but it's a load of substances that are not poisonous. These are children. And then I hung around them for like 3 hours, these little middle class kids trying to act like they're hard with crack cocaine, just to make sure that they didn't do any, like the substance wasn't going to go. But I threatened my guys because I'm not there for that. I'm not there to do stuff around children. And then there was another situation, and there was a guy that wanted to get out, and the crew didn't want him to go.
You mean he wanted to leave the criminal lifestyle that he was leading with you and your friends?
The problem is when you say it like that, it makes it, the problem is when you say it like that, and I know that you're coming at it from the best intentions, but it makes it, it adds to the myth. Like, and that's the problem. It wasn't that at all. The guys are doing a move. They're doing a hustle. They're doing something in order to make money. This guy was involved in that. And then at the last minute, he's now saying he doesn't want to do it, which of course is going to, anyone, like, you imagine if you're a plumber, you've arranged a plumber to come round, and at the last minute they've said, oh, no, you know what, job's a bit different. They have to start all over again. But except what we're doing is illegal. And the problem with that is people are asking, why does he want out? Why now? Who's he talking to? All of that stuff. And the onus was put on me to put pressure on this guy to complete the thing, because at the end of the day, money's there to be made. Well, I travelled to this guy. He wasn't in this country. I travelled to him fully prepared, and I could see it in his eyes because he'd brought his girlfriend along with him, which was the number one thing you do not do, and she's flipping out about it. And if this move goes wrong, they're going down. They're going down for a long time. So I thought I was doing the right thing. And I let him go, which was stupid because I was told he's either doing it or we've got to start seeing some blood. And then when I did that, the guys were like, well, no, actually, if you haven't done as we've done it. And it wasn't the first time. There was another incident before that. So this time I was in a situation now. And I mean, the reality is it doesn't matter what I say, because I explain this stuff and no one believed it in the court. So it's no point talking about it now. But at the end of the day, yeah, I was harmed. I was absolutely harmed. And at the end of the day, people would say this. The funniest thing about it was I was able to come out of prison. Like if I was working with a client and they were as involved as the way I was, I would be really worried about what we would do with them now. But the reality was, because I paid with my silence when the charges came, and even to this day, I mentioned nobody.
So what would you caught and sent to prison for then?
So this is the funniest thing. Do you want to know the blessing? The most amazing blessing about it is, on paper, it doesn't even say what it is. Like the law, so on paper, it says like something like being knowingly concerned with some sort of, it doesn't even, I think it's like knowingly concerned with class A. It doesn't encapsulate what happened. So nobody really, really, truly knows anyway.
Was it a supplying, importing drugs?
It doesn't say supply, and it doesn't say, I think in like the importate level, it doesn't say that I was the carrier. It doesn't say that I was the drug mule. No one was actually sure in the chain where I was. That was the problem. And what actually, the problem that happened was when I was being interviewed, my social construction, like, I don't know if you get what I mean, but where my mindset was, it was actually angry at the police for because I'd gotten away with so many offences. Like, I thought I owned, and like, you have this mad sense that you own the police and the police will do what you say. So I'm telling the guy, of course, I mean, I take my hat off to him. I was threatening him in an interview. I was threatening him. And I mean, serious, like, let's get it right. I was saying I was going to kill him. I was going to rape his wife. I was going to do all sorts of. The guy sat absolutely still. He must have just thought, you know what? This guy must realize how much trouble he's in. But in any case, it made no sense, because I was banged to rights, and that's how it came down. And like I said, that night, so you understand my mindset. That night, it was like everything had just come down. Like now. Like, I was abstract from the problem and I could see what was going on. I knew things had gone too far. Like, when the guys turned around, like, so when I was told to head somewhere before I came back, and then I was stripped naked and all sorts of stuff had happened. I knew things had gone too far. And actually, I was thinking to myself, once this thing's over, it's over. Like, I need to come out and I need to be running a life that's away from all of this stuff. There comes a moment in time where things go too far.
So sorry to ask you again, Junior. So it was for drugs, though. So eventually you...
It was Class A drugs, 100% purity, and the quantity was massively substantial. And I could say this, it had never been brought into the country in that way or seized in that form. It was a new form, which no one had ever seen before.
And is this crack cocaine?
This is powder. This is 100% purity cocaine, not crack. Crack cocaine is a subsidiary. What we were calling this was a suicide mission, one to test a new way, like a form of gel. But another way was to. It was a new type of synthetically created product. So it's what we called a suicide mission. If you get away with it, the payoff is massive. And that's the reason why I got the charge I did. And people often say, oh no, you have to end up loads of times in front of the judge to get sent down. That's absolute nonsense. Those people tend not to be from minoritarized groups, do they? You know, I can almost tell you the colour of a defendant by the charge they get. But let alone the fact that it's drugs, like let's be completely honest, there's a certain type of offence that, and I know this because I'm a criminology student now, I'm doing my PhD, so there's certain types of offences, and it's the same thing with women. Like, women get sent down for the first time for their offences more often than guys do. Like, we have, like, they've had this thing in the judicial system where they say, like, well, actually, a woman who commits a crime is effectively like kind of like a devil, and they need to be removed from society for their own safety. And that's a very common thing. So these are all sorts of stuff that people talk about but they don't really refer to. So, yeah, I got sent down.
12 years for drugs. You say your first night in custody was a wake-up call. You know, I don't want you to document the dotted 12 years and how you coped and what you did. But I do want to get a sense of what life was like for you in prison. You know, you were obviously going into prison with a reputation.
but it was your first time being locked up. I mean, you've been in police custody before, question, charge, but this is now real prison, as in your sentence. You're going to do some time, some bird, whatever you want to call it. How did you cope, and what was the reality for you? And just remind me how old you were at the time, Junior.
By the time that last charge came, I think it was about 24. So I'd been at that point, I'd been involved in that group offending very seriously for like 3 solid years, 4 years. So, yeah, it was massive. It was a massive culture shock. I don't know if you or any of your listeners have ever seen Shawshank Redemption. But, you know, one of the things I've got to say that film gets really, really right is that you can actually hear the walls wailing. The first night in custody is almost like a, you know, like you're in nursery. You know what I mean? They've got you in a nice, cushy space. You're allowed to make phone calls, all sorts of stuff. And then they move you into the real pack. And then it is like a pack of what? And like you actually, at nighttime, you can hear the walls wailing. Like people are just crying. And I mean, yeah, I did. The first night I was in custody, I was there. I was hitting my head against the wall, blaming God, blaming life, blaming everything. It was really, really hard.
But yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. And myself. You know, I remember I got the first phone call in, and because my sister was shocked, you know, she got, you know, because she got the neighbours around, and some of the neighbours knew what I was involved in purely because, you know, the problem was is you kind of, we connected into the community in a way that was both strength and fear. So parents would say to me, oh, look out for my son. I've got to do a couple of extra hours tonight. Like, and I'd do it. Do you know what I mean? But they would have known I wasn't involved in nothing illegal. But anyway, people were around the house and I was saying to my sister, you know, I'm really sorry I effed up. I've really made a mess of this. And I heard one of the neighbours say, tell him, you know, he effed up, but we all love him. And it was just a massive, massive crazy.
This is why you were in prison. You were talking to your sister.
Yeah. On the phone, on the prison phone. Yeah, on the prison phone.
What was the turning point for you in prison? So you're now, you're destined to serve these 12 years. And people do their bird differently, don't they? Some try and play the hard man. Some just, you know, disappear into the shadows. Others just try and hustle and navigate the years without really thinking about the time, you know. How did you do your time? How would you describe the time that you spent? And when did those pivotal moments come where you started to change, if at all?
From the first night, I started to change. So what happened was I said to the officer at Crawley Police Station, look, there must be some support for people out there like me. And he says, well, where you're going, there's the Samaritans and you can call them out and they'll listen to you all night. And then he just shammed the shutter in my face. But my entrepreneurial spirit was going and I was thinking, well, if I don't want to call them out, I want to join them. If they're the ones providing help and support, that's what I want to do. I'm not going to say it was easy. It was a massive struggle. First night in, really, really hard. It's like moving on to the moment, it is like you're walking amongst wolves.
And where was you? What prison was you sent to?
So I was actually on remand. They had me on remand for 8 months. So before all this terrorism offences, like my case is documented, I've been one of the longest people to be held on remand. So it was mad. And that means you're living in this thing of where you don't even know what's going to happen. You don't know that with what sort of sentence you're going to get. You're brewing on this offence and everything. And I was also moving in the mainstream conditions, officers picking on you, like picking on me because I couldn't acclimatise to him. But it's a mad, it's the worst, craziest situation you can ever imagine. Banged up for near enough. So high down, bang up was 23 hours a day. You know, you're in an environment where like people are out, like people are bringing you drama all the time. The officers are out, so you can't get anything done. It was a terrible environment. And then the funniest thing is I had to acclimatise to it. And I was really fortunate. So you said all these different things. Did I just do a little hustle? Did I keep my head down? Did I fight my way through? I would say a bit of everything. I'd say a bit of everything. And then funny enough, here's what happened. There were some of the older boys on the wing. I think they felt sorry for me because of who I, because at the beginning, you know, I tried to take my life quite a few times, and they took me under their wing. They showed me how to survive, not only to how to find the jacket, but how to wear the jacket, how to walk with in it. I had to acclimatize, and people that I perhaps would never have gotten to know on the outside, except through some, they were now kind of like the people that were protecting me. Do you know what I mean?
You mentioned, attempting to take your own life. That must have been a real, I don't know, I say a desperate situation, a hopeless situation, but these guys kind of gathered around and gave you the support you needed.
It wasn't even them. I got sent down, got given the 12 years, and you've got to remember, so when you're doing 12, you do 2/3. So you're doing, so it wasn't like I was looking at 9 out of the 12. Then 9 years out of the 12, right? So there was a guy on the wing who had managed to smuggle in like a lump of heroin. I was looking at ways of how I could take my life without it being the most painful, and which is kind of like a cowardly way of looking at it. But that's how the only way I could describe it was, is if, you know, you do a drawing and you make so many mistakes, at some point you've just got to put it in the bin. There's no point going back to it. I planned it. When you do this stuff and your head's in the right mindset, you plan it. And basically what happened was I was going to swallow the heroin, because the idea was it would just make you go to sleep. And then what happened was, is I was preparing myself to do this, and so I heard these footsteps coming up to the door. And this officer just flung these pictures underneath. They'd been sent to me by a friend of the family. And what it was is one of my friends had lost both his parents. And that night we'd had a really good wake. And I said, well, I'm just going to get him absolutely wrecked. He's not going to remember a thing. And the pictures were from that night. You see, what had happened until that point, I was just a name and a number. And the way people were talking to me, I don't mean it in a bad way, but I'm sure everybody knows what it's like to be in an abusive relationship where people are talking to you like scum. People are gaslighting you. People are, and you, your voice is never heard. I could never say anything negative. I couldn't even so much as make a suggestion. They don't want to talk to you. They're just telling you what to do. You know what I mean? And you do what you are freaking told. And it just reminded me that I was a human being.
Seeing those pictures in the gathering on the outside world.
It reminded me of, like, no, I'm not that bad. I did the most stupidest thing. I flung the heroin out the window. my man came back. He was expecting to find the body. That was how we planned it. But he forgave me. He forgave me. You know, but he said, don't ever think of that. If you're not going to do it, don't ever think about doing that stuff again. And boom, I was on the path then. But anyway, to cut a long story short, my journey was just about how I wanted to make myself a better person. And the way I could describe it was taking like the shirt out of an iron, you know, like taking the shirt out of a tumble dryer and you're ironing one crease out and you're seeing another crease appear somewhere else and you iron that crease out. And it was a bit like that. I dropped out of school without any GCSEs at all. I came across in the prison environment. I worked out I get an extra 50p a week for every GCSE that I for every qualification that I get. So I did qualification after every. At one point, I think I must have been, they cap you at like £12 a week. And then, you know, I did all of that. Then I was like, okay. So what was happening is under the Samaritans, they've got like a prison listener scheme. I was coming across, I'd been trained up as a listener, right? So I'm providing support to other people going through times of crisis. And I was becoming aware of people that couldn't read or write. So one guy called me out. He said, what you're telling me, are you confidential? I'm like, yeah. He's like, he just pulled out this massive stack of letters, right? Can you read them to me? Yeah, can you help me write these letters back? And that's what I did. And then what happened was there was a guy inside Highdown who was in there for a really serious offence. I think it might have been manslaughter. He came across, he was reading one article in the officer's mess because he was like one of the orderlies, and there was like $5,000 up for grabs. And what we sat down, we're talking about, like, what could we do with this $5,000? Because he's like, let's apply for it. I'm like, we can't apply for it. We're serving inmates. He says, no, you've got to plant the seeds in the officers' minds of what to do and let them think it's their idea. Anyway, we come up with this idea that we would set up the toe-by-toe reading scheme, which would teach guys how to read in their cells. Yeah, we would use a section of the listeners to do it. He did the paperwork. I did the paperwork. We spoke to the head of education. They did the paperwork. We got the money. Toe-by-toe reading scheme is still active to this day in Swellside Prison. And then I was like, my gosh, if we can do that, I did that with nothing. What else can I do?
And what exactly is toe-by-toe reading? So and one prisoner would go in and read the letters or teach another prisoner to read and write?
There's only a couple of pictures, and one of the pictures that was taken of me was teaching a guy how to read and write in his cell. Yeah, me, the person that didn't even have a GCSE, was teaching somebody how to read the very basic, like the very basics. And then once you, so you start off with the basic letters, a bit like nursery, and then it's kind of like the letters and then the sounds, the phonics, and then what that looks like.
And how rewarding, I mean, no doubt that the prisoners, Junior, were benefiting from this entrepreneurial exercise that you and your fellow prisoners and staff were supporting them with. But how rewarding was it for you? And what did you go on to do? Because I know that you eventually got released from prison, because you wouldn't be talking to me now, but you got released from prison. But what did it spark in you? Because you do a huge amount of work in this space right now. So tell me a little bit more about, you know, the rewards that you've gotten and what you do now.
Guys, I'll tell you what it sparked in me, right? Everybody in life is kind of like out for what they can get. I don't mean it in a bad way. You wouldn't apply for it. The first thing most people do when they apply for a job is they look at the salary. What's the job involved in? Like, the reality was, is I think I found that life was always going to be more rewarding if I was giving. Like, I know it sounds weird, right? And I know there's like that, the famous thing, don't ask what you can, you know, your country can do for you. It's not like that at all. It's like I said to you, the sensitivity of where I am now is I understand that there's so much people that are in need, so much people that are less fortunate than ourselves, and nobody is helping them. Nobody is listening to these people. Nobody is even advocating. Like, nobody mentioned, you know, even when they talk about crime and stuff, no one's talking about the impact on the families. No one's talking about how that family is suffering. And somebody needs to do it. Somebody needs to do it, because the system isn't working. Like, let me tell you, I was saying goodbye to people on the Friday. By the Wednesday, the following week, they were coming back. And that, what I was able to see was the gap. Like, there were always something. Well, like, so either, you know, they're going to go back to the same area with the same associates, or they're going to come out and they're going to have the same issues running around them. And I'll be honest with you, my most unselfish time was also my most selfish, because I knew if it could happen to them, it could happen to me. And I was going to have my own stuff to come back to. And I didn't want my sisters and my family to be dependent on me. So the spark that was inside of me was, somebody has to do something. And I tried it the other way. I tried doing the smash and grab. I tried doing the legalized heists. And it wasn't ever going to work. So for me, it was always going to be about, okay, what can I do? How can I use my hands? And also, it was really humbling, because it wasn't like I've come at this thing about, oh, I want money, I want a big name, I want a big reputation. Those sort of things just came about as a subsidy. You know, my intention before, you know, you and I were talking earlier about the newspaper article, my intention was just to prove it could be done. And that's why I gave the clients everything in that first year before that newspaper article came out that said, like, none of my clients would be offended. That year wasn't at no cost at all. I didn't take any leave, but it was no point, because I was on license. Where was I going to go? It's not like I can travel and travel abroad. So I might as well dedicate myself to the job. And what I was saying to myself was, is on roads, I would have been non-ceasing. There would have been no time out, no nothing. I would have given it 100% if money was involved. So why can't I do it here? And that's how I did it. That's how I've been doing it with my studies. So I chased down and harassed St. Giles. I got the release on temporary license. I did have some really big supporters, you know, like the head of education in Blantyre House. She gave me a lot of help and a lot of support. And I just dedicated myself to the project 100%, 1,000%. And I still
tell my listeners what that project is. What is that project?
Let me tell you about SOS. So SOS Project is an ex-offender-led project. We use people with lived experience of the criminal justice system, of gangs and negative lifestyle choices. And exactly the same like the Samaritans, like I was doing in prison, we're providing one-to-one support to young people that are caught up in gangs, child criminal exploitation, and all of these negative cycles of behaviour. And then so I did that. That's still running now. We're coming up to the 15th year anniversary of that project. And SOS started with just £20,000. It was deemed too risky, but they were happy to try it as a bit of an experiment. And
why would they consider, I mean, whoever they are, but, you know, funders, I suspect, why would they consider something like that risky? Surely someone like yourself who's lived that life, talking to a young girl or guy to try and steer them away from that life, there's a win-win. You know, if you foul, at least you tried. If no one's trying, there's no chance of changing that individual's direction. I mean, how could they even consider that those are not the right ways to do things?
Raphael, you know, my mum used to say this, common sense just ain't that common, right? If you look at it, like, think back to when you were younger, would you have gone to a parent if you'd have had an issue, or are you going to go to your friends? Like, This is a very common factor. Like when I was ill a couple of months ago, I went to the hospital. They said to me, "Oh no, you know what? We're going to send you to the specialist department. Like, we've got knowledge, but the specialist department, they really know what they're talking about." Here's the reality: we've got an issue of serious group violence. Serious, like, you know, just before COVID. Do you know how many young people were murdered on the streets of London by violent means? 100. The youngest person that no one ever mentioned is because there was a lady that was killed and she was carrying a baby inside of her and it only survived for like 3 days. So everybody discludes that unborn, but I'm telling you, it's 150. It was massive. And yet still we have got people without the knowledge of what it takes, like actually coming in with prescribed solutions, telling everybody else what to do. But they're not from that lifestyle. They don't understand it. And then they don't understand why the young people won't listen to them. You know, the other day I was running a training session and the lady was saying to me, well, why doesn't he just do the CV? Like the CV, like if he just applied himself, created a CV, then he could apply for jobs. Like, I'm telling you, if your family is in destitution, the last thing you're going to be thinking of is building a CV. And that CV may or may not be the solution to the problems. And in fact, these families that we're working with, a CV is the last thing on their list, because before I get to the kid to get him to think about education, training or employment, I've got to help his mum access the benefits she's entitled to, because the state is failing the families out there. Make no mistake, obstacle after obstacle. And then before I can help her even get to that, I've got to help her deal with that relationship with that's abusive and toxic, that's making her have less self-esteem. But then before I deal with that, I've actually got to deal with her other children running up and down the house because they're mimicking their father's behaviour, which is abusive and violent to the mum, which is further damaged. This is all so where does healthy diet fit in that scenario? Somewhere after helping her get access to her benefit, somewhere after helping her level up her rent arrears so that she's got more money in her pocket, somewhere in the mix of that. And then after that, comes helping the son and helping them access the stuff. That's what it requires. I'll tell you something else that with the society is failing. They've got the wrong expectations. So the frameworks are very dated, Raphael. They're built up on this thing of, well, 1 hour, 2 hours here and there will be enough to change somebody. That's not what it's going to take. And another thing as well that this system gets wrong is it thinks that if you hit someone with punishment, then that will make them change, stop and make their tracks. I remember being in prison, a guy was self-harming and the prison officer was saying to him, well, listen, if you stop self-harming, I will enable you to see your son or daughter a little bit more often during the week. That's applying logic to a mental health issue. And many of the young people we're working with are traumatized. They've come from complex. And if it's not trauma on the street, it's trauma in the home. You know, the amount of kids I've worked with, and I have now worked with thousands that have said that how this started was home wasn't a safe place for them. They wanted to come out of the home, and that's how they got groomed, and that's how they got brought in. So that's why SOS is so valuable, because what we're able to do is, this is a time resource heavy. To come up with the solutions, you need time and resources, and you also need real empathy of where these young people are coming from. People with lived experience have that. But we don't just take anyone with lived experience. We develop them and we train them exactly the same as how the Samaritans did it, but we do it to an MVQ level 3. So that person, the aim is that they're not just going to become some super enhanced ex-offender, they're going to become a professional. That's what I want them to be able to move forward in their life, their life cycle.
Sorry to interrupt you, Junior. What's really interesting, I mean, you articulate the issues powerfully, you know, talking about having to address one problem, but before you can, you've got to address all the problems that come before that. And I think, you know, you don't hear very many people talking about it in the way that you just talked about it. And it's disappointing to hear and think that that person who sort of said, why don't they just do a CV, are the people who pull the purse strings or have the power to make changes, and yet they have no concept. Even in this day and age, when these problems are a cyclical, you know, they go on and on and on and on and on. Just one question. When you mentioned at the end there that the lived experience people that you work with and train, is there, and I understand why you do that, is there a danger when you take someone as articulate as yourself, who's lived the experience, is raw enough to reach that demographic that that person you talked about with CV could never get to? Is there a danger when you overtrain someone, over-educate them in that space that the authorities think you need to have qualifications for in order to, you know, apply the programs? Is there a danger that they lose their sense of connection with the kids and the relatives and families that they're trying to reach? How do you protect against that happening? Because we do, don't we? The more educated you become, the more your vision changes, your view changes, you articulate things different. And so you become slightly more removed from the world that you're trying to help, i.e. the kids.
I don't see it as a deficit at all, Raphael. I see it as a benefit. As an organisation, we need to be like a beating heart. Yeah, so people should be able to come in and move on. The problem that we have with SOS is that actually our turnover, staff turnover, is very low. And such is society that people come into the project and they don't want to leave because they're scared that actually they won't be treated the same, like, for example, as an equal somewhere else. They'll be tarred as the ex-offender. Sometimes they carry the ex-offender label outside of prison. Like, so you come up with, you must have come across these people all the time, people that they live out their label. The first thing that they, you know, they want to talk about is their offence and how it was a dark part. And I want them to move forward and past that. The third thing I want to say is that, you know, so when I'm sitting down with a client and, you know, a young person, I can talk street slang all day. What, you know, no one can tell me more about the drug game than what I've just been through. But that's not how the interaction goes. Like, my background is only useful when I think there's an actual, because the idea isn't to get it out there for the sake of me feeling better. And the idea should never be that I can take lessons from my life and apply it to the client's life, because the client life might be completely different to mine. I actually stay where I am. I want the clients to aspire to be something more than they are, because that's what we're seeing with the young. You know, half of the legacy of what we've got with the young people is they haven't got a sense of identity. Where has that been taken? That's been taken in the way that they've been educated. Look, these young kids aren't being told that they are kings and queens and that they are able to achieve. They're being presented with obstacles that are too low. Why else would they be chasing after the latest set of trainers? Why else would every young person want to be a grime MC? A grime MC is great for some, but for the vast majority, they'll never ever enter into that arena. But they think it's viable. Like, how many young people have you worked with that have come up to you and say, oh, yeah, I want to become a mechanic, or I want to work in neural surgery? That's not what's happening. These arenas, the arenas where these young people are coming from, isn't that their aspirations are high, their aspirations are too low. And that's what they're aiming for. And so it's up to us as adults to show them, like, look, you know, this is the way, this is possible. Somebody can become like you, Raphael. Someone can run a podcast. Someone like them, like with the mix. So what I'm trying to say with the kids, so for example, this kid was talking to me yesterday about, sorry, day before yesterday, about wanting to get involved in grime. I'm pointing out the people that he should be looking at. What about Akala? What about Loki? Yeah, these are rappers that don't swear and F and blind. These are people that talk about conscious stuff. If you produce that, if you want a qualification in music, like, don't just make music for the sake of it. Let's get your qualification in it. Then you can change your situation. And then what I'm saying to the kids is, once you get there, look behind you. See who's on the wayside behind you, and you help them get to where you are. And that's how we progress. That's how we become a nation of wealth builders. That's how we change our narrative, because the world's got enough of street soldiers. That, you know, people mystify my past. My past is way back. What do they do with the young people is insane. We need to change that narrative, man. Definitely.
I totally agree with you, and you have, haven't you? I mean, I know that the work you've done since your prison time has led to you winning lots of awards, the SOS Project, the work that you're doing with kids. I know that there has been a lot of recognition, well-deserved recognition. What are you doing tomorrow? You know, what's your ambitions? I know you mentioned that you are doing a lot of training at the moment in terms of, you know, furthering your education. I don't know where else you can go, because it sounds like you've already acquired enough in order to sort of tackle this space the way that Junior does it and the team around you. So what does the future hold? And I know this battle is endless, and it can come in different shapes and sizes. But just to bring this to a close, what does the future look like? What do you need? What do you want people to know you need, or the challenges? I mean, what's your message, Junior?
Oh, wow. Okay, but I believe that I really want one of the biggest messages that everyone deserves a second chance, and sometimes even a third chance and a fourth chance. Like, we all are human beings, and we all make mistakes. And I hear a lot of people saying, well, not everyone's like me. But believe me, there are loads of people that are coming out of custody. The problem that we have as a society is that we're limited by how far we spread our ambitions. At the moment, there's still only a couple of organisations, the Timpsons of the world, the Sainsbury's of the world, that will employ ex-offenders. And we're still coming up against this narrative that says that, you know, these people are risky individuals. Honestly, genuinely believe, with the right support, you know, amazing things happen. Amazing things happen when people believe in you, but even more amazing things happen when people give you a second chance.
An opportunity,
an absolute opportunity. And what am I doing tomorrow? Like, so I've embraced fatherhood. I recently became a dad.
Congratulations. Boy or girl?
It's a boy. And I've had to learn the hard way to release the rain. I'm very protective. I'm very, very, whatever's the most dangerous thing you can do with anything, he'll do it. And I've had to sort of like, kind of like, yeah, so like, I mean, if you had, yeah, I had a real problem with just letting him walk around the house. Like, I'm following him all the time. I had to sort of say, okay, all right, I'm going to be here. I'm going to be watching you, but I'm going to be give you some space and let you experiment and see the world through your own eyes, which you need to. But I've got some fantastic, we're working on some fantastic initiatives. I've never stopped being an innovator, and I'm tired of seeing things happen that just aren't working. In terms of SOS, in terms of the work we're doing, I would really appreciate any support from any of your followers, like just to follow St. Giles, follow SOS. We're not just lend us your ears, lend us your eyesight, and lend us your networks. Anyone that you think would be beneficial would be fantastic to the way forward, because we can't do this on our own, and we need as many people on board as possible.
And how can they get in touch then? So I know the St. Giles Trust, which is an organisation based in Camberwell, SOS is linked to the St. Giles Trust, which they go on the St. Giles. But you tell me and you tell my listeners how they can connect with you, you know, website, email address, how do they connect?
Brilliant. So the St. Giles Trust website is www.stgilestrust.org.uk. There's a tab up there that says work with us, support us. It's not just financial, it's networks. We really like connecting us with networks is really important. Talk about the work of SOS. If you click on the tab on there, you'll see SOS, what we do, where we are. We do school sessions to impart real tools. Again, it's not a scare straight model. We're there to impart real tools so that young people can make better lifestyle choices. We've got a range of sessions, everything from what happens with peer groups to the impact on victims and communities. And I'm out there as well in the Twitter space. So I'm @_juniorsmart. You can follow and see where I am. Like I said yesterday, I was at this anti-arms rally. I think a few weeks before that, I was talking about a race and equality to young people. Yeah, so follow our work, support our work, spread the word of our work. And where you can, like, support our work, it'd be fantastic.
Brilliant. Junior, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your personal story, your story that involves a lot of other individuals who no doubt have benefited from your journey, is now their journey. And let's hope that their journey will, as you say, bring others forward. Thank you so much for your time. Brilliant.
Thank you so much. Look after yourself, my man.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, share and follow us on social media at A Reporter on Instagram and Twitter, or Second Chance by Raphael Rowe on Facebook. As this is an independent podcast, all the support is appreciated. If you would like to sponsor or advertise on this show, please get in touch via social media, email or any other means you have to make contact. Audio editing is by Audio Avalanche. The original music is by J Road Productions. The cover design work is by Studio Minerva. This episode is produced by Daryl Johnston and Sophie Warner, and me, your host, Raphael Rowe.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.